Hello everyone, I'm Jim Pendrell. I'm here at the Manchester Business School today, and we're here to talk about the book that's been put together by some very esteemed professors here at the university called After the Great Complacence, which is all about the financial crisis and the politics of reform as of today. It couldn't be a more topical time to be talking about these issues. Here in November 2011, we're surrounded by a major European crisis around the Eurozone, not to mention further global issues as well. So it's a great time to be talking about this issue and talking about what could be done about the financial crisis. What I'd like to do is just go around the table and introduce who's here today. They are four of the co-authors of the book I've just been showing you about the great financial crisis. And they'll tell you what they do here at the school, and then we're going to have a debate about some of the key issues and conclusions that they reached in the book. So if I start with Carol to my left here.
Hi, I'm Carol Williams. I'm director of an ESRC-funded research centre, the Centre for Research on Sociocultural Change.
Hi, I'm Julie Froud. I'm a Professor of Financial Innovation at Manchester Business School.
Hi, I'm Adam Lever. I'm a senior lecturer in financial innovation. I'm also a researcher at CRESC.
Hi, I'm Ismail. I took senior lecturer in banking at Manchester Business School.
Yeah, thank you all. Well, one of the sort of key conclusions of the book is that one of the questions it asks, should I say, is are the today's economic and political leaders in a position to actually solve the problems? Will they be able to actually address the issues? So if that's the first question I'd like to ask the panel is, given the conclusions within the book, what do they think the prospects are for avoiding another banking crisis in not just the UK, but actually further afield as well, but perhaps for the UK first? Perhaps Adam would like to...
Well, I think this would give you two answers. I think we're sceptical, but there are two reasons as to why it's unlikely that problems have been solved. There's, a technical problem about misunderstanding the problems, and I think there's a political question about will. I think on the technical side of things, the problem has almost exclusively been framed as a kind of a moral hazard problem about how you make banks pay for the mistakes that they make. And so it's very much a kind of a cul-de-sac that we've gone down where we're focusing almost exclusively on capital requirements and all the rest of it. I think there's a secondary kind of issue around competition, that there's not enough competition in the industry, that this is also part of the problem. I think on the technical side of things, they need to address the four fundamental reasons why banking and the financial sector more broadly is so unstable, and that is problems around volume, around complexity, around opacity, and around interconnectedness.
Mm. That's a very ambitious list, but Ishmael, what do you think the prospects are for actually that list being delivered by politicians?
Well, I mean, it shows that the problem is complex and big. I think so far the politicians and the public in general and policymakers thought that they could do piecemeal adjustments like capital adequacy or focusing on the bonuses or recently Robin Hood tax. But what Adam has underlined and what we underline in the book is the problems are not easily manageable through those piecemeal technical fixes. I mean, we can put all those things under a broader umbrella of bank business models. And there's a clear sort of failure in dealing with banks' business models, i.e. how they make money, and have the top management in banking still drive huge bonuses 3 years after the banking crisis, whereas the economy is suffering, like Project Merlin in the UK. They don't lend to small and medium-sized enterprises. We still have in the UK Royal Bank of Scotland, 80% owned by the government. There's no exit strategy inside. Similarly, in the US too, we have big banks like Citi, still about 40% government owned. Bank of America not showing a big improvement in performance. And we see the situation in Europe. We have major banks are in serious trouble because of the complex interconnectedness. Like it's not just lending to Greece by French banks, but our French banks are connected with the German banks and so on. So it is significant, serious problem. It cannot be tackled with simplified regulatory responses.
And I believe you sort of call for perhaps a bad bank in the UK. There should be some more legislation to address the...
Well, it's not something that we developed in the book, but which, I mean, obviously the book was published in October this year, but went into press much earlier, and since then things have changed. So we're doing current research on the way things are evolving, and my view is we need to learn from examples like in Sweden and in South Korea about putting the toxic assets, bad assets of banks on a separate entity. And the Irish has done that. And to a certain extent, the US, they created a national housing finance agency to take on the big toxic assets of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. So I believe that would be a good way of separating from the balance sheets of UK banks the toxic and bad assets they still have difficulty in dealing with.
Adam, you talked about the Tobin tax, I think, in various recent papers, etc. It's been very much in the news at the moment, with various the fiscal agenda. Realistically, what are the prospects that even could go through, or even a shade of it sort of being getting through the political system?
Well, first of all, I mean, perhaps I think if I clarify why I think it's useful, if you go back to the issue of volume and interconnectedness, it would go some way to reducing both of those. If you identify those as fundamental problems, then actually making many of these transactions unprofitable to engage in will hopefully, I think, reduce the size of the sector and also undo many of the interconnections between these institutions, which makes it a little bit more governable. The prospects for raising lots of money, I think, is more doubtful, but actually as a mechanism for meeting some of these problems, I think it will be relatively effective. However, this does kind of connect to the question of political will. Mm-hmm. And here I think you are seeing some push within the EU for this. It's clear Germany have been relatively active in pushing for a financial transactions tax. The UK has given a little bit of lip service to it, but I think the position at the moment is it's a good idea, but we'll only do it when everyone else has done it, which I think is kind of that's pushing it to some point in the future and not really engaging with that option seriously.
Turning to the political will, perhaps bringing Julian and Carol here, we've seen just recently with the Paul's administration sort of perhaps the beginnings of a discontent amongst the wider world in the UK, certainly for one, and US as well. How do you think that links in with perhaps some of the conclusions you made in the book? Because there was a point here that it does political will exist to address these issues, and are people finding a voice to address those issues in the present political system?
Well, I think the protests reflect a whole series of kind of related concerns about growing inequality in society, and as Ismail commented earlier, the fact that the financial elites have continued to do very well whilst the effects of the crisis have been spread across the population more generally. So I think there's the protests in London and elsewhere are about general concerns about the wider effects of an underperforming financial sector. But I think they also reflect the complexities of the problem and the interconnectedness of the problem, that it's not about simple technical solutions. It's about more radical ways of thinking about finance by politicians, by regulators and others. So I think we've had several attempts at reforming the finance sector, and most of them have not got very far. For various reasons. One of the things we discuss in the book is about the influence of finance, and we avoid the notion of regulatory capture, which is often used to describe the relationship between industries and politics. And we use like the idea instead of regulatory closure, in the sense that the debate about finance has been closed down. And we think, you know, this is something that happened before the crisis, that everybody accepted that finance was a good thing in the UK. Politicians were being largely funded by the finance sector. Finance was very influential in terms of framing the debate about the benefits, employment, taxation, and other things. And the influence of finance carried over even after the crisis. So a lot of the early attempts at reform, we found when we looked at the composition of the committees looking at reform of the finance sector, we found that the finance sector was still playing a role in framing the debate. So it's a question about the continuing political influence that finance has, plus difficulties about expertise, as Adam and Ismail would explain. You know, finance is a very, very complicated technical subject. Many people don't understand it. The expertise about finance largely comes from the sector. So organisations like the European Commission struggle to get independent advice about reform. So if the knowledge is held by the sector, then there's a great difficulty in finding alternative foreign reform. So there's questions about expertise, there's questions about influence, there's questions about perhaps a lack of imagination by politicians, a hope, you know, crossing their fingers and hoping it gets better to avoid the need for radical reform. It's lots of different things.
Sure. I mean, Carol, this sort of strikes the heart, doesn't it, of the whole political dimension, isn't it, that they point people who are in the system to oversee reviews of the system and the whole cycle.
Yes, I think, you know, there are two sort of structural causes of the power of finance, one of which is that most of the expertise and knowledge about what they're doing is inside the finance sector. So therefore you're constantly having to turn, as Julie was mentioning, in the EU committee system, to the experts from inside the industry. The second, I think, structural advantage they have is that they're, in a sense, only defending the status quo. They only have to block reform, like the Tobin tax. Whereas, of course, people who want reform have to deal with very complicated issues and have to put together some kind of coalition of politicians and experts who could agree on driving through substantial reform. And so far, what we see is that in all the major jurisdictions, finance wins and the political classes and the experts have lost out. And the story is different, I think, in the UK and in the USA. In the USA, finance is winning through its ability to lobby the legislature on the regulations which will implement Dodd-Frank, which was in principle tough, but will be watered down at the regulatory stage. In the UK, you have a completely different kind of lobbying, which relates to how it's a smaller country, and essentially, it's the executive, it's the front bench politicians in both parties who are too close to finance, have bought a story about finance as the goose that lays the golden eggs, and are of course heavily dependent upon finance contributions.
This brings us very neatly to the question about the funding of political parties and whether this, we maybe need to see the genesis of a really more serious debate about how parties are funded in the UK. I know work has already started on that, but do you think this could be a tipping point for that, actually?
Well, if you look at it, 30 to 50% of the Conservative Party's funding comes from high net worth individuals in the city, and that's a very unhealthy situation. The problem is, of course, more fundamental, because this kind of influence for finance was opened up in all the major countries by the decay of mass political parties. It's the fact that parties are now essentially cliques of metropolitan politicians with highly expensive tastes for advertising to win elections. All of that, in a sense, delivers the political classes into the hands of finance.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's move on, if we dare, to the Europe, as the wider Europe, and we're meeting here today amidst continued turmoil in the Eurozone. Only this week we have the issue of the Greek referendum. Perhaps just open to all of you, really, what do you think the prospects are for you know, where we go from here? Does anybody really have any idea what's going to happen next?
Yeah, I mean, there's a big unpredictability. I mean, if you just look at what's happened over the last week. So there was an announcement just a week ago that there was a package to bail out Greece and recapitalize banks and increase the size of the fund. And then the Prime Minister of Greece goes home and makes an announcement and everybody is back to square one. So I think...
Do you think he was right to do that, to go to his people?
I think we need to look at the broader level. I think I'm against individualizing this problem. It's not a Greek problem. It's not. I mean, there's a tendency to turn these things into a pantomime. Yeah, bad guys. I think it's broader. I think politicians have failed to acknowledge and also discuss the issue at that broader level. It is not one country. It is the banking system, the financial system that the problem should be addressed at. But what that clearly shows is the social aspects of this problem is big as well. I mean, if you just look at the TV screens and what happens in Greece, it's not, you know, sitting in a room in Brussels and then technical guys bringing you a solution. So it's this pretty complex issue of dealing with sovereign debt, bank interconnectedness, and the social impact and political repercussions.
Mm-hmm. I would say that if you want to gloss on the present situation, things have to get worse before they can get better. I mean, it's quite clear that the level of austerity that's required in Greece is producing trouble in the streets. And that kind of austerity also tends to produce crisis within parties. After all, I mean, today's news is the Greek government is falling apart. And in 1931, the British government split apart on demands for public expenditure cuts, with the Prime Minister and the Chancellor of the Exchequer moving in one direction and the rest of the Labour Party in the rest. This is not unusual. I think what's frightening about the present situation is there's a semi-uncontrolled quality to this falling apart in a system which is highly interconnected. It's very clear, as Ismail was saying, it's not a Greek problem. It's a problem about long chains of lending within Europe, which tie everybody, including the Brits, together. This, in a sense, is Lehman Mark II, because the problem in the autumn of 2008 was the interconnections between the major investment banks. And we have quite clearly politicians who, by paying attention to their domestic electorates, are unable to deliver the kinds of policy measures which would be needed to reassure the markets. It's a very dangerous situation.
I mean, Julie, you touched on are politicians sufficient, perhaps caliber to grasp what's going on here? I mean, these are huge issues, very technical issues. You know, do they know really how to react to this?
Well, I think the difficulty is that the tools that people have at hand are very conventional tools used to dealing with more conventional problems. There isn't a script here for what's going to happen next, and therefore. Big questions about how do you recover growth in an economy? How do you insulate the economy from the banks? These are questions that people don't have ready answers to. So I think that there's a political challenge for the politicians, but there's also a kind of big intellectual challenge in terms of how do we understand these problems and the kind of policy solutions that are available.
Okay. One of the fascinating things when you read your book is how not only how prescient it is, but also the fact that these issues are going to be around for probably many years now. When you began putting the book together, did you ever imagine it would be published at such an opportune time?
When
you first...
We did, of course. You know, I claim my Rubini kind of position.
Because it couldn't have come out at a more better time, in terms of raising the issues and debate.
Yeah, I mean, the book... the book took several forms and we did change because we were writing at a highly volatile and changeable kind of period in time. And so just as we thought we'd cracked what was going on, something else happened, and we felt compelled, I think, to try and include that in the book and to try and explain it. I think that's the honest answer. I think in terms of having our eye on the ball, we could clearly see that this was, and I think we have potentially done this before other authors, we could see that this was not just an economic problem, this was a fundamentally political and democratic problem, and that if you wanted to get to the root causes of some of these problems, then you really need to think about changing the democratic structures in and around finance. And I think, as we see in Greece at the moment and elsewhere, that is the fundamental issue at hand. What may be economically necessary may not be politically possible.
Yeah, I think that it's quite interesting because all these books are kind of works in progress, which respond to events outside, which were happening as we were writing the book. I mean, for example, the whole of the Vickers Commission had not played out, but the whole of the Dodd-Frank thing had played out to the extent it was possible to discuss the failure of reform in the United States. And I think in that context, it was tricky primarily because it was difficult to get a kind of political handle on what the nature of the problem was. I mean, I think we spent a lot of time digging technically into banking business models and all the rest of it, which gives you a good understanding of what's gone wrong and what needs fixing. But I think the themes about the role of expert knowledge, the arrogance of the experts before and after, their unhelpfulness, and the themes about democracy really emerged as the book was being written.
And also, I think the issue of financial innovation, I mean, those things will be with us, and then that's something that the book also brings together the issues, topics that we've covered before the crisis, which like financial innovation, people thought would bring prosperity, economically, like securitization, collateralized debt obligations. And we still have that kind of view on finance, even after the crisis, that the reason why politicians, like if you look at London, the UK wants to keep London because it's where the financial innovation happens and probably where some growth will come from. That's the belief. But in the book, we look at how financial innovation, the way it has evolved over the last 10, 15 years, was bricolage, an anthropological sort of activity rather than a scientific activity within investment banking community working in small groups. So we also have intellectual academic debates on how we should understand finance and banking and challenge some of the mainstream ideas about what finance is.
Yes, I think that's very well summed up, actually, challenging the mainstream ideas. I think I think our politicians could do with reading this book and actually sort of educate themselves on the history of what's going on. So when's the next edition coming out to include the revised edition? Are there any plans?
We're not going to do the second edition just yet, I don't think. But I think, again, it really depends on how things play out. And that's what inspired us in the first place to kind of try and write this book, and it really depends what happens from here.
Yeah. As Ismail was saying, the book itself comes out of, although the book develops what we had to say, it comes out of a stream of articles and reports that we'd produced in the 18 months, 2 years before we wrote the book. And I suppose what we're committed to is keeping on publishing reports, working papers, academic journal articles on banking and financial reform. And maybe after 3 years, having another go at the whole set of issues. I think one of the really interesting things, and I think Julie's been thinking about this, is that it's quite possible that what we've discussed is phase one of the crisis. The period from Lehman to the Greek default, if you like, when in a way it was possible to contain the whole question of reform within expert circles and within the political elites of the different countries. That's really been what the whole story from 2008 to 2011. I don't think it's any longer, Julie, so clear that that's going to be possible in the next phase.
No, and I think that's what's frightening a lot of the politicians, is that people don't really understand the nature of the problem. So people hark back to kind of, you know, the 1920s and 1930s to try to find some reassurance about how long did it go on for and how did we solve it. But that's, you know, that's quite gloomy, because you're looking at the possibility of a decade or more of limited economic growth and austerity measures which are very difficult for the population as a whole to contain, and the possibility that we still haven't sorted out the underlying problems with the finance sector that got us into this position. So yeah. I think it's possibly a gloomy prognosis, but I think what we're trying to do is put different things together in our analysis. So we've combined the financial analysis with the difficulties of political reform. And in other work, we're also trying to bring other bits of the economy in. So we're looking at some of the regional aspects about London and the city of London versus the rest of the country to indicate that there's a kind of geographical element to this as well. It's not simply about the finance sector as one part of the economy, it's about London and its effect on the non-metropolitan areas. So we're trying to, I suppose, in quite an ambitious way, connect lots of different themes in the work, and the book is sort of one stage of that.
Indeed. Okay. Well, I think that brings us very neatly to the end of a very interesting discussion. Thank you all, and I look forward to the next edition of After the Great Complacence, phase two, from 2012 onwards.
3D version next time.